Hello everyone, welcome to the second season of the series of podcasts with IEEE Electron Devices Society Luminaries. As the world's largest professional organization, IEEE plays a significant role to enhance the quality of our life. Electron Devices Society, or EDS, encompasses activities involving electron devices, the main enabler for today's digital world. I'm Muhammad Mustafa Hussain, a professor of Elmore Family School of Electrical and Computer Engineering of Purdue University. I play a variety of roles in different capacities within the Electron Devices Society of IEEE. In this series of podcasts, we will be interviewing those EDS members who have made remarkable impacts in our society through their innovations and dedication. Our guest today is recognized for being the all-time seventh most prolific inventor as measured by number of U.S. utility patents. We are speaking with Dr. Gautrej Singh Sandhu, who has 1382 U.S. utility patents as of October 19, 2021. Gautrej Sandhu is Senior Fellow and Vice President at Micron Technology. In his current role, he is responsible for Micron's end-to-end silicon-to-package R&D technology roadmaps. The scope includes driving cross-functional alignment across various departments and business units to proactively identify technology gaps and managing the engineering organization to resource and execute on developing innovative technology solutions for future memory scaling. Dr. Sandhu's responsibilities include leading several internal project teams worldwide and managing interactions with research consortia around the world. At Micron, Dr. Sandhu has held several engineering and management roles. He has been actively involved with a broad range of process technologies for IC processing and has pioneered several process technologies currently employed in mainstream semiconductor chip manufacturing. Dr. Sandhu received a degree in electrical engineering at the Indian Institute of Technology, New Delhi, and a PhD in physics at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, in 1990. He holds over 1,300 US patents and is recognized as one of the top innovators in the world. Dr. Sandhu is a fellow of IEEE. In 2018, he received the IEEE Andrew S. Grove Award for outstanding contributions to silicon CMOS process technology that enables DRAM and NAND memory chip scaling. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing great, Mohammed. It's good to see, especially the COVID clouds lifting actually rapidly. So that's certainly a personal note, but also in terms of the technology and the space we are in. I'm feeling pretty good.
Great. Great to hear that. And yes, it seems like COVID is actually getting in our rear view mirror. We'll see how it unfolds. So I will start from the very beginning. And so that's actually with your childhood, fond memories as well as, you know, your school life. How was it?
Sure, yes. A lot of memories. Some of them fond, some of them kind of interesting. But I think overall, my childhood was a little bit confusing because my parents went to London, UK for their school. I was born in London, then they moved back to India for the job. So So I had a lot of, before the age of, you know, five, I had seen many countries and many cities. And one of the side effects of that was the language, right? It kept changing around me. So you know, you have something listed that was any regret. The only regret was that it took me a while to get into the groove of settling on a language and which language to educate myself in. And one of the interesting examples I can give you is I found out through my own experience as a child, the way you learn math and the language you use to learn math actually matters. It matters a lot. At that age. So because you're thinking, math is a language of its own, but your native language, the way they're teaching you, if they're teaching you in English, teaching you in certain other language, the way you absorb that information, actually it does matter. I mean, that's my personal experience as a child, actually. So it's pretty interesting that later I had the similar experience when I was teaching physics also, not about language, but something different. So overall, I think the childhood was very hectic from that point of view, but I remember a lot of things as a result of it because I saw so many different things. I remember seeing a ship on a water, I guess. I wasn't on a ship, but I remember seeing it because my father took one. And then I remember different places I lived in. You know, I lived in four or five different places by the time I was seven. And I have a memory from each one of them, something I remember from each one. And some of those are very deep impressions I still remember. So no regrets. Great. other than a lot of movement around.
No, I think it's a very interesting insight and perspective on how we learn language. You know, nowadays, you know, the language processing, speech processing, and, you know, these are very hot topics. It's more actually for the last two decades. My next question is, you know, let's talk about your college life, undergraduate life, like, you know, how much fun that was and how you get yourself into the, I would say, in kind of in the device engineering, like, you know, the scope.
Yeah, so growing up, you know, my uncle was a chemical engineer and he was in the US. He gave me my first calculator. This was one of those red LED calculators. And he also would send me these old Time magazines. And that's actually, I didn't realize it till I actually saw this question, to be honest, your question, that how much that influenced me actually. That calculator was, that was probably the only calculator in India at the time. It was very unusual to see those type of devices. If in fact they won't let me use it in class, they thought I was cheating. I said, well, you got to learn the log tables and all this other stuff. But that actually piqued my interest in, you know, what is inside of this? The whole electronic technology, it just made me think about it at a subliminal level, subconscious level, probably. I wasn't actively thinking about it. But at the same time, I kind of remember from my childhood asking a question, you know, I found out about life and death cycle, and I must have been five or six. I can remember where, the reason I remember how old was, I remember where I was, which city. And I remember thinking about it deeply. So I had this whole question, and my education was the similar thing. I wanted to get into the depth, into the fundamentals. So physics kind of helped me. Physics was interesting for me. It was not easy, but it was interesting because it was trying to get to the bottom of the basic questions. So this whole combination of this exposure to electronics device, you know, computer calculator being the most advanced at the time, and this innate kind of interest in trying to get to the bottom of the questions, right? Trying to understand the fundamentals, kind of led me into a space where I was kind of straddling between EE and physics all my life. So I'll go into physics, I really loved it. And they say, oh, you can't make money off you. How are you gonna make a living? Oh, you can make a living, but you know, it still was tough. You know, teaching physics was not that many professions. But then I would also go into EE. So I kind of went back and forth. But overall, my memory of that space, that time is, I mean, I'll give you an example. I had 2 months off. Those days there was no internet, no YouTube, I was bored. And I just went to the library and picked a book and read through the books. Now, some of them were literature. And believe it or not, some of those, one was on atomic physics. I just read it from start to finish. It was very interesting to me to understand, you know, how physics works. So those are my memories. I think I was shaped by some of the circumstances around me, but also I found it very interesting to gather knowledge and collect knowledge. And on the side, I was very physically active, sports, and I like to do all these things. I actually like doing music too, but I was not allowed. My father told me, no, you're not buying a guitar. They're not happening. Those are the days when music wasn't a career. Now it's still different. So.
Oh, great, great. I think, like, you know, the physics always tries to give answers on how and why. And so that, you know, that tracks our mind most often. So which college you went to for your undergraduate?
So for my EE degree, I went to IIT Delhi. And then when I came to US, I switched to physics. So I got my PhD in North Carolina on the East Coast. So that was kind of the mix. I went back and forth, and it was solid state physics. So by that time, I had realized that even a graduate degree in physics, there are jobs in industry, and there's more jobs than I thought I was told when I was growing up. So,
right. So if you can kind of share some of your experience during your PhD research, your advisor, the teammates, anything that that comes to your mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was a very formative year in some ways for me. Of course, you come to the United States, you have this culture you're trying to adjust to. During those times, it was a little harder because you didn't have as much information before you got here. Now it's a little different. People back in India know a lot more about culture here than it used to, and the vice versa, actually. People here know about some of these countries. When I came here, no one guessed I'm from India. I was either Saudi Arabia and somebody said Japan. And I never figured out how they thought I was from Japan. So that adjustment took its time. But at the same time, on the academic side of things, my professor actually had worked at IBM before he went into teaching. And he actually picked this was the time when this synthetic diamond deposition was just coming. Somebody found an old Russian paper, old means 10 years old Russian, translated it and figured out you can do a CVD deposition of diamond. It's possible, right? So that was diamond was a huge topic in the mid to late 80s. It was an interesting time in general. Superconductivity came about the same time, the AFM, STM. So it was a very golden decade for me, when as a physics student, I saw a lot of exciting things happening. So he kind of decided that he'll get into devices on diamond. We're going to make MOS transistor. So the first step is how you dope it N-type, E-type. So that was kind of my project. And then I say, okay, but where's the substrate, right? Oh, don't worry, I took care of it. He opened up his bag. He had just come from a trip to South Africa, opens up his bag, there's a little small box. He says, here you go. There is 21 diamonds inside of it. And these are natural, purest form of diamonds. Don't lose them. They're more expensive than jewelry. So now from there on, I had to guard those because my degree and my future was dependent on, I wasn't going to get a whole lot of new substrates. So I had to kind of plan everything around those. And I remember, those diamonds look like a piece of glass. They're not like they're flat piece of glass is the way they're built. And once in a while, I'll kind of drop them. You use tweezers to handle that, right? These are small. They'll just flip from the tweezer. And I remember being on my hands and knees, lab is closed, looking for that piece till I found it, half an hour. It's transparent pretty much. And so those experiences, and it was pretty interesting in the sense that it was a challenge which nobody had achieved before. We made some success in terms of demonstrating ability to dope. To make it N-type turned out to be very difficult. And to this day, nobody's been able to kind of truly do N-type because it's fundamental. So in a way, what I was not able to do, and that was actually foundationally difficult, it's good to know I didn't miss something, something obvious. But that was kind of my grad school days. And after that, of course, I came to the Silicon world. So.
Great. So it's kind of like, you know, the reminding when we hear about diamond, it's like, you know, the diamond haste. But you know, at such a young age, as you mentioned, that you had to preserve them and to use, actually figure out eventually one of the allotropies of carbon and diamond, like, you know, working with them. As you might know, the diamond has, you know, they re-emerged as one of the interesting research materials, active substrate materials. My next question is, please share with us about your first job after your PhD, and how was your experience? You know, did you like it, or, like, you know, anything that you would like to share?
Sure. So after graduation, you know, I applied for a few jobs, and I usually like to tell the story. You know, I ended up at Micron barely by accident. And there's two reasons I say that. One is, you know, during those times you had IEEE Spectrum magazine, right? There was nothing online. And you looked at the ads in the back and applied for jobs. That's the way it worked. So I applied for a job, came here, got the job, then went back and in my apartment, I had the magazine just sitting there. And then I looked at it a little carefully. That magazine was actually 2 years older version of the magazine. I applied for a job which was not even posted. It was posted 2 years ago. It was not right. So, and then the other piece there is that I had a job, I had offered from a larger company, and Micron was very small at the time, and it was in the same business. And then I asked my professor, you know, about my feelings about the job. You know, this company, you know, I came to Micron, they're telling me they have international competition, they need to compete with 15 companies. And my other company, they were trying to say, you know, sugarcoat a little bit, oh, we don't have much competition, don't worry. It was in the same field, in essence. So I asked him, I got the feeling, you know, these guys over there are hungry, but I may not have a job after 2 years if they don't survive. It's a small company. So this is where, you know, my professor kind of gave me guidance, which I met him actually last December. I've been telling him, you know, he helped shape my decision. He essentially said, professors kind of know their students. You know, after parents, they spend the most time, they know personalities of their students, and they know, you know. And he basically said, and he had been at a bigger company, right? He had spent many years at IBM. And he kind of said, and the sentence he said, if you go to Micron, you will do many things. And what he was trying to say was, in a larger company, usually you'll have a very limited role that puts you in a box. And I don't think you're meant for a box. That's not how you operate. Because even my grad PhD on diamond, I did 5 different measurements, 5 different things, a lot of different things, all on my own. And my thesis committee asked, did you actually do these measurements? I said, yes, on my samples, I did those, I learned. So he basically said, if you go to Micron, you will do many things. There is a risk, but you're just starting. In 2 years, find another job if it doesn't work out. So that was the basis of my decision, because I couldn't choose between safety and what my gut was saying is the right thing. So I came to Micron. So in general, you know, when you go from grad school to industry, it's different. You know, the pace is different, the responsibilities are different. And so I liked the pace because I could run an experiment and get 10 times more data available to me. Whereas in grad school, I had to kind of collect everything myself. It was kind of slow. But at the same time, you don't have as much freedom either, right? So it was a balance between those two things. But pretty soon, you know, I realized the challenges and all. And so my actually first 2 years turned out to be, in my career, at the time, it wasn't obvious. It was frustrating at times. Okay, you know, maybe I should have done a postdoc, right, somewhere. But those turned out to be my formative and golden years in the sense. It set me up for the rest of my career. And it was just an opportunity. You know, I got to work on certain things, certain processes developed at the time, which became so foundational. But at the time, you know, as I said, you know, it was a mixed feeling. It was a good thing, lots of data, a lot of things to do. At the same time, felt like these have to deliver to a certain goal, which at the beginning I didn't fully understand, but once I started understanding them, I felt that freedom. Well, if you don't understand why you're doing something, you feel like you don't have the freedom. The moment you understand the end goal, why this is important, then you'll do the same thing and feel good, better about it. So that's kind of what happened to me.
I think, like, you know, I would like to thank you for articulating in such a succinct manner, but at the same time, like, you know, that you delivered the right message, because I kind of had the same, like, you know, the experience when I first joined TI, and I was doing an internship, elaborate internship in Sematech. Then I moved to TI, and I could see, like, you know, the, what were the differences between working in a large organization versus, like, you know, the little bit, like, on the smaller one. But I think, like, you know, that this is going to be very helpful for many, many graduating students to understand that where, what kind of experiences they can expect, and hopefully can prepare themselves. So I will now actually would like to ask you about something. And, you know, that you are someone who has an extraordinary number of patents, US patents, under your authorship, you know, as an inventor, as one of the lead inventors, close to 1500, right? And this is an amazing number for many, many, many people. At a personal level, when I first got my one, that was just after, you know, before my PhD, and I still remember that day, like, you know, the, how I felt. And my question is that, like, you know, that when you look at this spectrum, right, this is a very unique experience for yourself. So if you can kind of share, like, you know, that a few things. First, that how does it feel today? Compared to the day one when you first actually got, you learned that, okay, so your patent has been awarded. So that's number one. Number two, that do you believe in Eureka moment? And if so, like, you know, that if you can share a few things about that. And among all these 1500 or so, like, you know, that if you can pick at least one that you, you know, that you remember, like, you know, cherishly, like, you know, that, yeah, this is something that made, still makes you very, very happy, that brings a smile to your face. Okay, so three questions in one shot.
Yeah, so regarding patents, you know, I didn't know much about how that process works or what's important. I knew what a patent is, but once you join Micron, at the time, there was a lot of litigation going around in the industry, so Micron said patents are important. So they were in general giving out, you know, these kind of messages. But my main passion was and always has been to solve problems, right? Solve problems. And I always had this out of the box approach. I go back to in school, actually, I remember in IIT Delhi, there was a digital class, a digital electronics quiz or a midterm. And there was some equation you have to write and draw the gates, you know, how you draw a circuit to meet this equation you have mapped, the logic, right, equation. And I doodled and I found an answer. And then my teacher gave it back to me, and she circled that thing and called good, and wrote a little good in there. And then I kind of said, you know, why? Say, well, this was not the answer, but this is a correct answer. You found a different way to find, to show that same different circuit to do the same logic, which was not the answer in the book. So I kind of, that stayed with me. You know, I always had this trait of trying to solve the problems, but then trying to go out of the box. So that was always with me. And in grad school, I did some of that. So coming to work at Micron, it was the same thing, right? But then the patents came as part of it. So my first, and then big idea, you know, so usually, you know, my manager told me, have you written a patent disclosure? I said, what is a patent disclosure? This is a patent payment dinner, right? So I go, okay, yeah, I should go do this and this. So, okay, we did that. But then, of course, there's a lot of support system. So I guess when you talk about the patents, it was so many patents, it was probably multiple factors. Of course, the corporation needed to have patents, so they had support systems. They were encouraging. I always had this way of thinking outside the box to solve problems. And there were plenty of problems to solve, right? Micron was number 16th in the world in a list of its 17 DRAM companies. And our focus was on moving fast on technology. So shrink the chips faster than everybody else. That's the only way we're going to survive, right? In terms of the lowest cost. And that required a lot of innovation. And so I was at the right place at the right time, and there was patterns going on in some ways. And I remember coming on weekends to write those disclosures, right? I mean, you have a day job, obviously, you're solving problems. And I would, one of our CTOs at the time, he was legendary to be working all 7 days. And then he'd run into me all the time. He says, you know, so he didn't say much, but eventually, you know, he recognized that this guy is crazy. Yeah, he just shows up. And I showed up only because I felt it was interesting for me to do. And after grad school, from student to this, you know, you can still do that before you have families. Now, I think I have actually three patents for a different reason I want to tell the story. So my first one, essentially, we had transferred a technology from another company, a DRAM technology, which we're evaluating. And as you know, in this technology, the number of masks is a very high level of cost. And I was just a new engineer, kind of looking through the traveler. And I thought, you know, there's a way to maybe reduce one mask, you know, and still make the device. And I'm thinking through it. And I said, okay, but these guys must have thought of it. You know, maybe it doesn't work. You know, I don't know. I'm just like, this is my third month into the company. Then I slowly walk up to somebody senior, eventually the CTO. I say, I have this idea, but maybe it's not good. So I draw it up there. And he just takes me by hand and takes me to my manager. He's got an idea to save one mask. And he goes to his boss and says, okay, we hired this guy. He's reduced one mask on this globe. And I'm just thinking, what happened, right? So then, of course, you know, they want to write a patent. So that went through that process. That was actually my first experience of just trying to solve the problem, because they said reduce masks. I said, okay, here's an idea. Then they said write a patent and so forth. My second one was 2 years later, which turned out to be very foundational. It was essentially a process to deposit CVD titanium, which is very important, right? You do PV, you can do physical spur deposition. You don't have a conformal deposition. Our structure.
Yeah, the liner.
The liner. So our structures in DRAM, we were trying to push to very high aspect ratio structures. And if we could do that, we could reduce mask. We actually had a 6-mask advantage over the rest of the industry. We had six less masks on a total number of 18 masks, 30% less masks. So there was a lot of encouragement to, okay, go push this process side of things so we can keep that advantage. And I look at, you know, okay, how do you deposit it? I look at a different simple chemistry. I drew up an equation. I said, okay, this is obvious. So let's try to go do that. And as I tried to do it, it turned out to be much difficult because I didn't realize it's not as easy. Of course, titanium is a very reactive to oxygen, right? So you can't really deposit titanium there. So there's a lot of engineering struggle. At the beginning of this project, my boss told me, go write a patent. And I, for a year, didn't write it. I said, come on, this is high school chemistry. This can't be, people must have known it. So after 1 year, you know, with a lot of innovations on top of that, engineering type of solutions to actually realize the process, I had this one wafer full of silver looking material, and I'm showing it to, you know, my CTO and my boss, my manager. So, okay, so how's that patent going? I said, no, I didn't write any. Come on, I thought it was no big deal. So, no, you should. So then I actually had the library search on this topic, and I couldn't believe there's nothing, not even a paper. Then I realized I understood why, because it's not easy to realize in practice. The equation looks okay. Chemistry-wise, but you know, you don't have the right driving reaction rates and so forth, and you have competing reaction rates. So then I wrote it, you know, reluctantly. Okay, you know, I'll write it. That turned out to be a process now, which today, this day, is used by the entire industry, right? And I, for a year, didn't even want to write a patent on it. But I did realize now, because engineering challenge was much more than I thought, because I didn't know all those challenges. But then I realized those. So that's kind of one anecdote there. My third example would be later. So this was like me, one man army going after it, right? So this was that experience. It was all me. And then the third one is this pitch doubling on NAND, which happened many years later. It was a similar kind of a question. You know, the idea has been around before. At the time, we had a new CTO who used to share office space when I joined. And we had this idea at the time, you know, 10 years before, it didn't work. And I kind of knew why. And next time around for NAND, we start thinking about it. I just knew that I had to introduce a new material to make it happen, because otherwise flow fundamentally doesn't work. So we finally did it. We skipped two generations, NAND and Intel got into NAND. It was a big outcome, but it was more of a big team. I was leading a team to do that. So slightly different experience, but it was a similar type of inflection point, so to speak, to enable something in a different setting now, in a team setting. And then of course, huge, the entire industry used it eventually, obviously. So those are three. I mean, and I'm not saying they're the most, some of them are, they're important, right? So there are others which came about. I had one which they woke up and I had an idea, and it came during my REM sleep or something. I don't know what that was. So there's a lot of other stories like that.
Oh, that's great. One of the things I think, the take home message at some point you were mentioning that even over the weekend, you still used to show up and bumped into, your CEO or CTO. But I think that what it says that you said that you just found it interesting, and it might be a little bit difficult for many, but for some people, they just love what they do. And that keeps things moving. There's no financially specific advantage or anything any other perks. It's just they enjoy what they're doing. And I thanks for candidly sharing that. And this is a very important and I would say an inspiring, the message. I would like to actually now switch to a little bit lighter portion of our conversation, which is very popular with our younger audience. And we call it the rapid fire round. In this round, I will be asking you some questions, which actually allows us to know you up close at a more personal level. We anticipate that you will be able to answer in one or two words, but you have the freedom to elaborate as you want. Okay. Whenever you're ready, just let me know. I'll go ahead.
Sure.
Okay. What are your hobbies?
Anything related to something physical and music.
Okay. Music or movie? Which one you enjoy more?
Music or short videos, short movies, just because they're shorter and you can do more of that. I still watch longer movies, but they take a lot more time.
Okay. Which is your favorite genre of music?
Yeah, so I mean, growing up, the Indian classical and the Indian music, Bollywood music is what I was exposed to. Of course, then I've expanded that. I found that the music is a language of its own, actually. It's a universal language. So all kinds of music, to me, I see commonality in that base of that music. Every music, to me, has its common base.
Yeah, obviously. And as a physics enthusiast, you find the physics of sound, the physics of, I would say the motor mechanics, our biomechanics, and obviously the creativity, everything is actually playing there. What is the book you are reading now?
Yeah, it's been a while since I read a full book. Usually try to go with, shorter version of review papers, or even sometimes the YouTube videos summary of certain things are very good to kind of go after. So the one which I think which stayed with me is still the Stephen Hawking's biography. And it was on two different levels, right? Obviously, I have interest in physics. We're trying to understand this universe, where it came from, what does it all mean? So there is that. But also the personal story of, his struggles and what he had to go through and still achieve what he achieved in life. So I could really relate to both of those in a way. So that stayed with me. I mean, I like a lot of other books too. I've read a lot of other books. I like to read books which have either a message about the human condition or society or a larger question about, a universe in the terms of where does it come from, a larger understanding, instead of a small, trying to solve this small problem locally, university as big as it is, we need to be thinking bigger and then thinking about where this all comes about and not about thinking about, you know, my city and my people and my house and my this. So anything which takes me in that direction, I like all those books.
Okay, means inspiring and / or insightful.
Yes.
Okay, what is your favorite cuisine?
Actually, I'm very open on cuisine. Of course, you know, I grew up on the North Indian cuisine, but I found eventually as I traveled that I'm pretty open. But I did find my limits though. So in Asia, as you know, sometimes when they really want to treat you well, the food has to be very fresh. Sometimes fresh means alive, right, on your plate. So I figured out. So I said raw, maybe I can do alive, maybe not. So I found that limit. But in general, I'm very open to trying different cuisines as long as they're healthy and they're usually healthy, you know, because for every different culture. But I have to be careful about what I eat in that setting to make sure I'm safe.
All right. Okay. Any sports you enjoy?
Yeah, actually, I enjoyed all kinds of sports. So in my undergrad and grad, I just played all kinds of things, you know. So I picked up basketball pretty big way. Then I went to North Carolina. I said, okay, that's pretty cool. And Michael Jordan came from there. So I have pretty much played all kinds of sports in my life and liked them all. Cricket probably I played the least, and not because I didn't like it, but I need efficiency of exercise. I need to be doing something. So in cricket, I was either a bowler or I would be a batsman. When it was time for fielding, I'll go behind the wickets, be a keeper. And this is when we didn't always use to have a glove. So I'll go with my bare hands behind because it was more activity. It was more engaging for me. So.
Right. What is your favorite travel spot?
Yeah, I'd like all kinds of places, warm mostly, but actually the one activity I like the most from a travel point of view is cruises, except, you know, of course the food part is not good, right? So you have to kind of keep track of that. But the reason I like cruises, I like the type of cruises where every day you're hitting a new spot, you're seeing something new. And ideally, if it's a cruise where the weather is not all the same. So like Alaska cruise towards the north, there's different weather patterns rather than, you know, the Mediterranean is the same weather all day. So I kind of like those type of travel experiences.
Okay, very good. So we are now in the last portion of our conversation. Here we will take a look into the future through your perspective, your eyes, okay? From that section, my first question is, what is your thought about electronics in the future?
I think electronics in the future is here to stay. If anything, the progress we have seen, our generation has seen the most progress over the last few generations. It's on an exponential roll. It's going to keep impacting us even faster, exponentially, so to speak. But the flavor of electronics will change. You know, the Moore's law and the devices, that revolution is going to have a different inflection point. But overall, electronics impacting our life, I don't think it's going to change. It's going to increase it.
Okay, is there anything that strikes your mind which can be better today? It can be anything technological or non-technological.
Which can be better, what?
Is there anything that strikes your mind which can be better today?
Yeah, I think in general, as we speak about technology, it has been inevitable through our whole history. It is going to be inevitable in the future. So education about technology, having the right perspective about the technology, especially for the new generation, is extremely important, right? So students need to be, they don't have to turn engineers, but they have to understand it the right way and not completely ignore it sometimes, right? Because technology is part of it, part of us. You can be afraid of it, you can fight it, but it's not going to go away. The reason is that if you have an educated population about the technology, they will hopefully drive for the right type of policies, public policies, to be enforced to make the best use of technology. Because if you don't use the technology in the best way, it can be used for the not so good ways, right? Nuclear power, you can think, you know, power, electricity versus the weaponizing of it. Similar, you can say same thing about every other technology, and coming with AI coming up soon, that's even more critical, that the average student gets educated, so the population of the future is involved, not just doesn't ignore it, and then influence our public policies in the right direction.
Great. What application would you like to see in the future that does not exist today?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, of course, you know, we have a lot of applications. We can travel now without any piece of paper, right? And even 10 years ago, not that long ago, I mean, this phone, we have smartphone, people don't realize. We didn't have it in 2005. That's not that far back. So you have these utilities of convenience, right? We see those. The question now is, and with machine learning and AI, there's more and more capabilities. If I say, you know, on the energy side of things, fossil fuel side of things, maybe you can talk about solar, electric cars. So the energy side, the progress has been slow, and this planet cannot really support it. So we got to use more and more technology there, not only to create different forms of energy, but also conserve, right? So use the electronics around you to not waste energy. That piece is extremely important with sensors and all these other things which are happening. So I would like to see more of that so we can actually protect environment. This environment is more precious than what we usually think, know or think about, because this, and we need to preserve it. And we need to use the technology to preserve it. Because part of the reason we are using these resources at a rapid pace is because of technology. So I think we need to turn around and use the technology to give back.
Okay. Very good. So from the scripted one, my last question is, what is your one piece of advice or suggestion for the younger generation?
Yeah, it starts with, you know, the cliche, you know, be curious, for example, you know, so we are all born curious, actually, right? I mean, so as we grow older, we get either distracted, you know, with different things, or we are actually trained then not to ask all the questions you want to ask, or we are trained to conform. So I would say, you know, the younger generation, they should stay curious. Education is about curiosity, and it's not about passing the grade and feeling burdened. Learn. You know, education is about tools on getting the tools to learn. But what you know doesn't matter. Every year, education, the knowledge is changing so fast. So I would say they should be curious, but they should also learn, think about education as tools to learn rather than a burden on them. But again, I think I go back to the same thing. They should be curious enough not to use technology, but try to think about it. Try to understand where it comes from, pros and cons and all. Get engaged with it somehow. They don't have to be engineers. Everybody shouldn't have to turn engineers, but you don't want to just have a black box or a blind eye approach to technology. You want to engage and think about technology, because it is influencing our lives more than people realize. It's shaping our lives, and it's going to be even more and more in the future. And the last thing I want to add there is that because of technology, we are realizing now, right, in the last, you can start with Galileo, that this planet is pretty small. It's not as big as we think, right, in this universe. So so it's very easy. We are programmed to kind of think about our group, this group, and the younger generation, I think, is already realizing. They should realize it even more that there's more of, they should be more open to understanding others, right? So this planet is too small for us. I mean, there's a bigger things to go understand. So be open to ideas, open to, and in fact, the innovation happens the best when there is more diverse ideas being included. So you have to be inclusive, and it's even more important going into the future. And as you're learning, especially for the younger generation, as you're assimilating information, be open to all the ideas before making, you know, final judgment. It's extremely important. You can always have a It's like knowledge. Right? If you have incomplete knowledge, you'll have wrong conclusions. Get the complete knowledge before you make a conclusion. Don't be trying to use other people's conclusions to make your own. Right. So younger generation needs to really be thinking. Their future depends on it in a way.
Right. Thank you so much for such an animated and very insightful conversation. So this is my question for you, and this is not scripted. Was there anything that you wanted to discuss or you wanted to share, but I didn't ask you?
No, I think you covered a lot of things. I think we already covered my Eureka moment on the technology side. On the personal side, my Eureka moment happened maybe a few years ago. As a physicist, you already know the universe is so big, right? But then you go back to the knowledge from the older books. This is not I'm not talking about the formal text, but there's, like, I was just in Greece last week and I understood, realized, the knowledge they were trying to gain was scientific basis, right? And there are other cultures in India, for example, and China, which, thousands of years ago, they had certain knowledge pieces. So my Eureka moment was that some of these, humans as species have been trying to think about these bigger problems in a very inclusive way for a long time. And it's not a new concept. Physics is a formalized way to do that. But people have been trying to, before physics, they've been trying to answer the same question. To me, there's actually more similarity of thought in the world than less. Now, we don't see that, because what we see is a less similarity, because there are people, the middlemen, you call them, they're trying to, prescribe their own logic and they haven't even thought through anything. So my Eureka moment was, there's more of oneness on this planet and in the whole universe, which is exactly what the physics is trying to achieve. So I connected the world we live in to actually the concept of physics, which we're trying to find this one universal force in a way, right? So we have identified four forces. So there's gotta be one equation eventually, right? So anyways, this you may or may not want to include, but my personally, my Eureka moment is where my quest for this truth using physics and my understanding of how people have been, non-physicists have been trying to find the answer, there's more similarities than not. If you really get to the bottom of what they were trying to answer, you have to sift through all this other stuff in the middle, which is more of a marketing to make, get your attention.
Thank you for attending this IEEE EDS-sponsored podcast. To listen to other EDS podcasts, as well as benefits and resources EDS offers, please go to the website eds.ieee.org. Thank you for listening.